Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. Click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, or the YouTube channel, which also includes quick take reviews of select movies and more. That is at the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. You can also check us out at patreon.com/SonicCinema. I finally got a new Leaving the Collection going there. I've got a couple of these films that we're going to be talking about today that are going to be up as far as first watches, some brief thoughts on those, and more. That is going to be at patreon.com/SonicCinema. So I can't remember if this is the first time that my October horror for the podcast has been basically dominated by Phil Faso. Both episodes are with Phil, and the previous one we talked about the new Salem's Lot adaptation as well as the different adaptations that that movie has had, that book has had over the years. And then we've actually got another episode down the pipe that kind of sort of ties into this one, but I'm not quite ready to say how. But we are going back to a tried and true formula for us, talking about horror movies from a specific year. And the year that we chose, I was originally keen on doing 1984 because you had Nightmare on Elm Street, you had Friday 13th Part 4, and, you know, I thought that would be a good discussion. But then Phil mentioned, well, why don't we do 1974? And I looked at the year, and I knew a couple of the bigger titles as far as horror. And then there were a couple of other titles that it's like, oh, okay, this would be really interesting. So we are doing a 1974 horror episode. But first, let's go ahead and introduce our guest, who this year is probably going to be the most he's ever been on the podcast. This is already going to be his third appearance this year, including the Joseph Cotton episode. But please welcome back to the podcast, Phil Faso. Phil, thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, it had to be difficult, Brian. Sorry about that. Changing the 80s to the 70s on there for you. It's a pleasure, as always, my friend. The thing is that the 80s are so dominated by slashers.
Yeah.
And I think we've discussed this before. Slashers are that and found footage are probably my two least favorite types of horror films. Mm-hmm. And the 70s have always been my favorite decade for films in general, horror films and general films. So you're going through the whole, it's the golden age with Coppola and so many guys. And even if you want to go beyond that into the horror realm, you have, you know, a whole bunch of exploitation coming out from Roger Corman. There's all sorts of creative life teeming there right now. It's just bubbling up with all this creativity and this passion. And it's in my opinion, the greatest decade for filmmaking. And I was very happy that you had said, yeah, let's take a look at 74 instead of 84. So sorry for being difficult there, but glad you were accommodating as always. And again, you know, I just want to say I always love coming on here. I do this weekly if it were a thing, you know, because, you know, I love talking to you. We always come to these great conclusions and we always, you know, our conversations always get me to think about things and look at things a different way. And I hope it does the same for your viewers here. So,
yeah, I always love our discussions, regardless of what we're talking about. I am glad that you pushed for 74 because of the fact that this particular episode, we are going to be talking about one filmmaker we've already talked about on the podcast a couple of years ago, as well as a franchise we talked about a couple of years ago, funnily, amusingly enough. But we're also talking about two filmmakers whom have not been discussed on the podcast before. One is, I've heard the name before, but I am not as familiar I'm not familiar with his work, so this was my first time seeing a film of theirs. And then another one who is part of those movie, that movie Brett's generation with Coppola, with Spielberg, with Scorsese. And we're going to go ahead and start off with his film. It is a really, you know, it's funny because of the fact that this, when I brought this up as a possibility, is like, yeah, that's kind of horror, right? It wasn't until I saw it, because this was my first time seeing it, but I'd heard about it for years and knew I was curious about it, that this is a very quintessential horror story. We're just not quite used to seeing it in the way that the filmmaker, Brian De Palma, who is, you know, this is a couple of years before Carrie, he's made this. It is his 1974 horror musical romance, Phantom of the Paradise. And I don't know why it didn't occur to me that this is basically a modernized take on Phantom of the Opera. And I think that's, I don't know if I've discussed it much in the podcast. I know I've mentioned in reviews before. I am not the biggest fan of Femme of the Opera as a story. Like, even, like, the only time I think it's really, really connected with me was when Meredith and I saw the musical live several years ago. But, like, none of the film versions have really connected with me. And I will admit, this is probably the first time that that's actually happening. I think it's the way that De Palma adapts the story to the modern era.
Oh, I thought that this would be right in your wheelhouse, because I'm like, this is a musical,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, Brian's the music guy, Sonic Cinema, this has to be his, it's got to be right in his wheelhouse. And we can talk about the songs and the structure and all that, but yeah, it's got a lot going on. Like you said, it's a musical, it's a horror, it's a romance. And it is one of Brian De Palma's most intriguing films. For one thing, it's one of the earlier ones that does not lean into Hitchcock territory at all.
I would agree with that, but there are definitely some moments that do start to hint at his obsession with Hitchcock as an influence. There are like scenes and there are shots that very much scream Hitchcock for me in this
movie. Oh yeah, totally. But it's not like Dress to Kill, which is his twisted version of Psycho or some of the other ones, you know? Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's not Dress to Kill, it's not body double words. Like, it's very directly his take on that type of material.
Sure.
I mean, honestly, body double may have been intriguing one if we had done 1984, but
yeah.
Because that's kind of horror, but I mean, it's more suspense. It's very much in the Vertigo vein.
Got a giant drill going through a woman. I think it qualifies as horror.
Just a little bit. Yeah. but no, I mean, and it's funny because of the fact that there was a podcast that I listened to that a couple of years ago. They did like a double feature of like kind of weird movies from the 70s, and one of them was this and the other one was Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And so that was part of what made me kind of interested in finally watching this. But the thing is, thinking about those two in connection, they're both about the music industry, and they're, yes, both about like the twisted ways of the music industry. I mean, this one in particular, I think, does a really great job of leaning into kind of the more sinister elements of the modern music industry, but also with staying within the vein of Phantom of the Opera to a large degree.
Well, I think what's really brilliant about this film is that it's not just the remake of Phantom of the Opera. It's about corporatizing art.
Yeah.
And how devalued the artist becomes within that process. So yes. We were just talking off camera about you've made some short films and you've done, you know, music for films. I've written a bunch of scripts and I've made a couple short films myself. You know, If, and I'm going to talk about this later, but well, maybe I'll just bring it up now. When I was watching, because I haven't seen It's Alive in a long time. So I watched it late last night after I got off work. And I'm like, this couple that are having this baby are not what you would call conventionally attractive.
No.
If that movie had been made instead of 74, if that had been made in 94 or 2004 or 2024, you would have much more attractive, conventionally attractive people in there as the couple.
Oh, no, like, doubt. No doubt.
Would have ever had those two people. At a studio level, there's no way you would have had those two people. Like, you know, so the whole thing is, in order to get big the way entertainment is set up, like, look, it's not like Michelangelo is going painting the ceiling of a church that the world's going to see for the next thousands of years, you know?
Yeah.
It's, hey, listen, if you want to make music, if you want to make movies, if you want to make art, okay, if you want to make stories, a lot of it has to be on the lower level if you really want to control it, right?
Right.
Because really, there's a point where an artist comes and, in this case, literally sells out by selling his soul to get his music. So I think that as a creative myself, I think it's a fascinating look in this movie at exactly that.
Well, before we get deeper into that, not just making his, not necessarily just the idea of getting his music made, because Swan, the Paul Williams character, who's basically the music, the stand-in for the corrupt music producer in this one, he is interested in taking Winslow's music for himself and basically using it for himself. So Winslow sells his soul to maintain control of his art to a certain degree. And that's what is the most interesting part. It's not necessarily that he wants, in order to create this art, in order to control this art, this is the only way seems...
In order to get exposure, in order to get it out to the world, all right?
And to get credit for it.
And get credit for it, yes. Yeah. I mean, look, I can talk about... My brother hates Led Zeppelin. I think Led Zeppelin's a very talented blues band, blues, you know, rock.
Mm-hmm.
But hates them because Led Zeppelin took a bunch of classic blues songs from the 30s and 40s and 50s, changed a couple words, changed the titles, and then on the original prints of those albums, listed themselves as the writers.
Yeah.
So that's a perfect example. You take somebody else's art, and it's even worse in this case because Swan is not a creative,
no,
right?
No.
And that's also funny because that has a double edge because Paul Williams, who plays him, obviously is a creative. You know,
an extremely
extremely talented, and he's kind of lost in time. I don't think anyone's like, "Hey, I'm going to the Paul Williams concert." Or I was listening to his album last week. But the thing is, like, this is so many different levels here of what's going on with who controls art,
right?
Because if you want to put it out to the masses, you have to commodify it, right?
Yeah,
you have to get someone to put it out there. So obviously, 74, you don't have the internet. I wonder if it was 2024 and Winslow were around, if he would just have started a YouTube channel and put all his tubes up. No doubt.
I mean,
that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so much, you know, and the thing is, it's like so much of, I almost feel like, in a way, the music industry is both benefited the most from the internet as well as had the most detriment to itself from the internet. I mean, it goes back to Napster. It goes back to, right, it goes back to this idea of, oh, you can find any piece of music that you want if you're willing to look at it, and you don't necessarily have to pay for it. Now, eventually the corporations, through iTunes and everybody else, they figured out a way to wrestle that from the consumer to their own, for their own devices. And now, like, it's basically every streaming site for music is essentially, it's basically like the streaming sites for movies or TV at this point, where it's like you subscribe and you have unlimited opportunities for music, but some people don't necessarily have their music elsewhere. And then you had the advent of like Bandcamp, which basically brought a bit more control in the hands of the producers and the creators of music to be able to have their revenue stream controlled by themselves as opposed to record labels.
Sure. And, you know, it's this whole thing about at what price do you want to pay for fame? And it's not even necessarily fame. At what price do you want to pay for your art to be seen?
Yeah.
Right? I'll give you an example here because a bunch of years ago, I bought one of Lloyd Kaufman's books about, it was Make Your Own Damn Movie, it was called, right? Because that was when I first started screenwriting. And there's a foreword in there by Trey Parker from South Park.
Yeah.
Because they made this little movie coming out of film school, and it was basically, it's called Cannibal the Musical, right?
Yeah.
So no one would meet with them. They're like, no one's like, this is unprofessional, it's garbage, we're not meeting with you, blah, blah, blah. So they meet with Lloyd Kaufman, right, at a Del Taco. I remember that detail for some reason, maybe because they like Del Taco. Anyway, they meet with Lloyd, and Lloyd says, yeah, we'll put it out there for you. We'll put it out on DVD and whatever. And they say, okay, how much money are you going to give us? And he's like, well, we really can't give you anything. So like, well, why are you telling us that? We're not going to make any money. Why would we give this to you? And he said, look, you made the film. Do you want people to see the film?
Right.
And as soon as he said that, they agreed that, hey, we're not going to make any money off this, but it'll get out there and people actually see it, as opposed to 12 of our friends in Colorado here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always the one of the things about art is you want to put your art out into the world as an artist, as a creator, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here's poor Winslow with his 8,000-page Sonata or whatever it is. I don't remember what
cantata. It's like cantata. A 300-page cantata.
Yes, there's 300-page cantata.
Insane for a piece of music
He hasn't even finished it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So this thing would take like 700 hours to listen to, pretty much.
Yeah, basically. No, it's insane. It really is.
But we go and we start off this movie with this film where they're trying out musical acts. And we'll get back to the specific three-man band there because they shift. It's funny the way they keep shifting depending on what the era is for the music. But, you know, Winslow is trying to get his music here out there. And Swan basically says, all right, well, we're stealing this. We're kicking him out. We're saying he stole our stuff. And Winslow ends up going to jail because of this, right?
Yeah.
So he's actually being punished for being an artist, which is another fascinating thing, you know? I get all kinds of feels for this because I've been writing my entire life. So, and you're a creative too. So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I get all kinds of feels when I watch this movie because I can understand Winslow's plight a little better as a creator than as a consumer.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you want to get your art out any way you can, right? If you're an artist, that's your goal. You know, I happened to start to create music at a time where the internet was really starting to be a really starting to be a bastion of getting it out there. Whether, you know, it's like the first place you could find my music online was mp3.com. And, you know, and then I, then after a little bit there, I started putting albums out on CD Baby, which put out in the stratosphere when it came to streaming. And then now it's Bandcamp primarily. And, you know, it's like, and there are still music websites there. And I mean, you can still make some money, but for me, it's really not. I mean, this is because of the fact I have a full-time job, so I don't have to worry about my, I don't have to stress about my art, whether it makes money or not. But I, you know, for me, it's not about making money so long as I can feel like I'm getting my music out there. And it is discouraging when you don't feel like you can. And, you know, I've been fortunate to be able to basically control how my music gets brought out into the world for the most part. But you completely empathize with Winslow in this case because of the fact that it's like he is being punished for being an artist. He's punished for having talent in, and Swan is benefiting from not having any. Which again,
no,
plays to the Swan, talent of, Swan, plays to the irony of having Paul Williams in the role.
No, and Swan is totally creatively bankrupt.
Yeah.
What he's done is he's amassed a fortune by basically stealing other people's art.
Yeah.
And he's going to make money on the backs of the creatives. And once they're done, he's going to cast them aside. Or in the case of that band I was talking about, the three-man thing, he's going to constantly recast them in different images with different genres and styles of songs. But, you know, poor Winslow breaks out of jail and I every time I watch this movie, I'm like, this poor bastard, like, he did nothing wrong here. And, you know, he ends up creating this whole image now as he is the Phantom of the Paradise. And the Paradise is the theater that, Swan owns, I guess. He owns it, right? Yeah. And he has taken it to go up into the rafters and haunt the place and create new music. And he's, you know,
after Swan, he's very nearly died. That's an important part of it. He's very nearly died. He's deformed by the time he becomes the Phantom. And, you know, it's because of the fact that, like, he's been basically, after breaking out of jail, he's trying to break into Swan's industry to try to wrest his music back. And he gets deformed in that way by a printing press, a record printing press, which is a really darkly ironic moment and also a very funny moment. And then he ends up seemingly dead. But I would, you know, and the thing that I was kind of surprised about was, I mean, this is part of what makes the film so great, is the fact that Swan is very aware of who the Phantom is, who Winslow is in this new visage. And it's fascinating to see how that dynamic plays. But to your point, it's basically Swan is going to use Winslow to create art. And yes, Winslow is going to get credit, but he's never going to be able to have that moment where he's in the spotlight because of it.
No. And there's a point later with Garrett Graham where basically Winslow's like, not Winslow, I believe Paul Williams is like, listen, just, if you don't like the words, change them. I really don't care. Like, do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
Like, hey, listen, I already have stolen this. I don't really care what you do with it now. Just get out there in front of the people and make them happy. Right.
Right. Well, and also in that moment, so Gary Graham's character is basically the lead singer who Swan wants to be the main performer in the cantata.
Yeah, the face of this new Swan era. Yeah.
Yeah. But the ingenue, and this is where it gets back to Phantom of the Opera, is played by Jessica Harper's Phoenix. And she is somebody who Winslow met very early on in the film, and she recognized she's actually genuinely talented. She wants to be involved in this for more than just being around Swan. She wants to be genuinely
heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, she wants to be heard. Just like Winslow. Winslow's got his talents creating the music. She's got her talents in singing it. But it's funny because she won't compromise earlier on because she's like, he's got a whole bunch of these girls and he wants to just throw them and they're like all just lying around and there's this lesbian orgy that's kind of suggested.
Yeah.
It's that. And she doesn't want to be part of that. She's like, I don't want to have to sell myself to do these things to sing in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sell my soul, which is essentially what he gets Winslow to do.
Right.
But it's kind of funny later on, and I know we're jumping all over the place with this, but there's that very creepy love scene, that sex scene between Paul Williams and her, right?
Yeah.
And Winslow is watching through a skylight at the top of Paul Williams' apartment. And Paul Williams knows that he's watching, and he's like, I'm going to zing you one more time.
Yeah.
This is the one thing you want that's not musically related. Actually, it kind of is, because she's singing this.
Yeah.
This is the one thing that's not directly tied. Well, this is the one thing that you want outside of your music being put out there, and I'm taking that from you, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whoever thought Paul Williams could be that evil?
Right. No, I mean, every time I've seen Paul Williams, he's jovial, he's entertaining, but he's, you know, he's a decent guy, you know, and so, like, so the idea that he's this evil individual, it's like, wow, he's really effective in it, too. I mean, that he was a great talent, but,
oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just really such a surprising role for me, for as somebody who's only known him in particular ways. And it's so to see him in this way is just fascinating. So,
and I love the fact that he absolutely relishes in it. Like, he's clearly all in on playing Swan.
Yeah.
And he's clearly all in on making Swan evil. And the way he does it, I mean, you look at Paul Williams and I'm like, I'm not thinking that this is somebody frightening or scary, but goddamn. He really he goes all in on playing Swan.
No, definitely. And I am trying to look it up because, yeah, he looks like he's still going.
He's still alive.
Yeah, he's 84. He's been in a ton of stuff too, and he's done a ton of stuff. So it's like, yeah, I mean, but yeah, this is such a big change for me, and I mean, that's one of the things I really like about this generation of filmmakers, where it's like they weren't necessarily afraid to cast some of these actors against their the iconography that we're familiar with them for. And I mean, some of them, the ones that are still making films, still are not afraid of doing that. And that's one of the things that's really exciting about this generation of filmmakers. And I mean, I love, you know, the thing about De Palma is that, I mean, yes, so much of the film is, so much of his work is obviously inspired by Hitchcock, in, if not directly, in terms of genre. So the fact that he made this, I mean, you know, and credit to him, he was, let's see, bring it up. What? how old was he? How old was he when this film came out?
I think he was in his somewhere in his mid 30s, somewhere around there, I think.
Yeah, he would have been 34. So he was on the older side of the film brats, along with Coppola.
He was making films like he only broke big. Carrie was the one that really broke him big in 70s.
Yeah.
But he actually made a bunch of earlier films, some of which star a very young Robert De Niro. And it's crazy to see Robert De Niro. And you could see him, you could see in those formative films of De Palma's, he's forming a style, right?
Yeah.
He hasn't quite gotten where he will get with Carrie and Dress to Kill and Blowout and those type films, or even here. And some of the stuff in Sisters, which I believe is the one directly before this. But
yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, you can see him starting to develop those in his formative films, right?
Yeah.
But I think that the most Hitchcockian thing here has to be the split screen with the bomb.
Because
with the split screen, that's totally De Palma. And
it's
all over the end. It's all over the prom scene in Carrie toward the end once she, you know, goes fully telekinetic there.
Yeah.
And so here you have it. But this is the classic. You see the bomb go onto the cart. You know it's there. The characters don't know it's there. And it's not when it blows up. It's the anticipation of waiting to find out when it's going to blow and what's going to do. That is classic, classic Hitchcock.
Right. No, absolutely. And he had definitely been around. So the fact that he was already familiar, I mean, a lot of these guys were really, as far as they were kind of familiar with the fraught nature of the industry when it comes to having, being able to do something personal, right? Sure. And I mean, this is an independent film. It's Edward R. Pressman, who's one of the great independent film producers of all time. And he is somebody who's very much, he's somebody who's always allowed filmmakers to experiment a little bit and to challenge conventions, to challenge genres that they're working in. And, you know, I think the fact that the fact that De Palma uses Phantom of the Opera as part of the structure, but doesn't necessarily, but finds his own way into it as a way of talking about the industry, I think is really fascinating. And there are two films that, you know, thinking about this film, there are two films that I feel like were probably very much inspired by this, but not in any direct way, but in the way that the filmmakers approach their own respective subjects. And one is Amadeus, you know, with the dynamic between Salieri and Mozart. And then the other one is The Prestige with Hugh Jackman's character constantly trying to one-up Christian Bale's character, but always seeming to have to go deeper and deeper into selling his soul to do it.
Sure. No, that makes perfect sense. And the thing is that it's kind of funny that you look at it in a modern context and you could say, well, you get all these independent filmmakers who make these, you know, small films, some of them Oscar winners. And then Marvel plucks them up and says, okay, here's your Eternals movie, right?
Right.
And then they're in the studio system now, and all those brilliant touches that they showed in those smaller, very intimate, very personal films to them are basically gone because now they're part of the machinery.
Right.
So I think that The Eternals is the one that was directed. I don't remember her name, but she was the one who directed a film that I believe her film directly before that won the Academy Award for Best Picture.
Yeah, Chloe Zhao. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I can't imagine how crushing it has to be to win an Academy Award. And then you get all this money to go make a Marvel movie, and they're saying, okay, well, here's the meat packaging plan. Here's how it works. Just throw the switch and just step aside, you know?
Well, it's funny because of the fact that some critics friends of mine, we were waiting for a screening of Inara to show up and come on the other day, and we were talking, and Eternals did come up in the fact that, you know, one of the things that came out in the lead up to Eternals was the fact that Chloe Zhao wanted to film on location, as opposed to, you know, using volume, using green screen and stuff like that. And Kevin Feige's like, what? Why would you do that? So, I mean, you know, Eternals is an interesting example because of the fact that, I mean, I know it gets a bad rap. I've always really liked it, but it's probably, you know, and it's a mixed movie, I'll grant you, but at the same time, it's one of the few movies where I feel like a filmmaker was really allowed to try to do something different visually. And so having that indie, and I mean, I think her coming off of the Oscar for Nomadland was probably a big part of that. But the fact of the matter is, it's like, it's an interesting, you know, and I think there are other examples. I mean, I think Shang-Chi is a good example of an indie filmmaker who's probably, you know, who's in that position of like, okay, so here's the way we make movies, do what you need to do, and then we'll take care of things in post-production.
See, now that Shang-Chi, out of the ones that come after the Avengers ended, is my favorite of all of them, because Shang-Chi is really a 1970s kung fu flick.
Yeah. The no, bust, I really, I'm not saying it's a negative, because I'm a big fan.
No, I totally understand that. What I'm saying is, without that particular director,
you
never would have had that bus scene play out, because Marvel fighting scenes, a lot of them are just so cut and dry. It's same one. But that bus scene, and then when they're in the nightclub and they have the multiple levels with the bamboo and all that, and they're running up and down and swinging off bamboo, those type of things without that particular creative on that never would have happened.
Yeah,
but I can only imagine that you probably have to turn mountains to get that stuff into a Marvel movie.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. Or you have to have cred with them in terms of a track record where you've made, you know, so many hits in a row that, or, you know, you've made one monster hit and they want to get you back to it. No doubt. But yeah, I mean, it's, no, I mean, I think I'm so glad that I'm familiar with Phantom of the Paradise now. You were right. It's very much up my alley for a lot of reasons. And no, it ended up being a really great choice here because of the fact that, you know, especially once you get the handle of the fact that it's kind of De Palma's riff on Phantom of the Opera, it's like, oh, okay. So this is something that I'm down for what De Palma is doing with this material. So I think it's a terrific film, and it's probably one of my favorite De Palmas actually right now. I mean, there are some of his that I still need to catch up with, but yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with it.
And I have to let you know, because I'm pretty sure that a lot of people will be unaware of this. When this movie came out, it totally bombed.
Yep.
Nobody saw it, except in Winnipeg, Canada. So Winnipeg had embraced this movie when it first came out, and it became a huge hit in Winnipeg. And to this year, I think this is the 50th anniversary. Every year they celebrate it and have a big film festival wrapped around this particular movie. So I don't know what the people in Winnipeg got out of this that the rest of the world didn't. But for some reason, they have embraced this film, and that is the greatest thing in the world as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. So let us continue then with our 1974 horror. And this one is another one that's very new to me. I'd never seen it before. And it is also my first time watching a film written and directed by Larry Cohen, which I'm familiar with his name, but I'd never seen a film of his before. And this one is called It's Alive. And why don't you set the stage for us?
So before I do that, I have to just go back to something on the last podcast we did, and you'll see how this relates. It's 1993, right?
Right.
I'm in college. I got married very early. I divorced within the same year, so we won't talk about that. But my ex-wife, at that time, when we were together, she was a huge horror fan, right? So this is the day when Blockbusters were still popular, and Hollywood Video and all that. So we rented a lot of horror movies at that time, right?
Yeah.
So I know that I said that I'd seen everything related to Salem's Lot, and I totally forgot about this. So we walk into the video store, me and her, one day, and I'm looking at a box, and what do I see? I see Barlow, Master Vampire, on the cover of the box. But I'm like, okay, this is not Salem's Lot. What the hell is a Return to Salem's Lot? So I pick it up off the shelf. We rent it, and it's a Return to Salem's Lot, except for the use of the town has almost nothing to do with the original, the novel, the movie. It's just a name steal, basically. Larry Cohen apparently had written a script for the original that they rejected, and they went with a different script from, I believe it was Paul Monash, and they went with that one instead. So when they were asking him, when Warner Brothers was asking him, because he had some kind of 2 or 3 pitch deal with them, and he already was in the works on one, what would you like to do? He said, well, I've always kind of like wanted to get back to Salem's Lot. And we made Return to Salem's Lot, which, Ryan, is one of the worst horror films that I hope you never see.
Well, okay, I will say I do stand corrected because of the fact that he did write the script for Phone Booth, which I have seen. So, and it's pretty good. It's a pretty good simple premise and execution.
Yeah, it's a potboiler. So, it's not bad. Okay, so 1974, right? So Larry Cohen is an independent filmmaker, wrote a bunch of his own stuff, wrote scripts for other people, made his own movies. He was basically an exploitation filmmaker. Okay. Mm-hmm. That extended the horror, he actually created one of the greatest blaxploitation flicks I've ever seen. That would be Black Caesar with Fred the Hammer Williamson. Definitely worth seeing if you're into blaxploitation. Fred the Hammer is always great when he's on film.
Mm-hmm.
And around the same time he's making that, he decides to make It's Alive. Okay? So this is the story about, and starts off with this couple. They're in bed, and the wife wakes up, and she says, I'm ready to give birth, right? And they have this son, and they send the son out to, I don't know who that other guy is. Is he a family friend or an uncle or something? I couldn't establish who that guy was.
Yeah, I'm not anyway, sure. Anyway,
regardless of that, right? So they get to the hospital, and she's going into birth, and he's looking at the babies in the maternity ward, the father there. And there's a scene where the fathers are all waiting for the kids to be born. My wife's been late for 6 hours. Let's play cards. I'm reading a magazine, whatever, right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, he's standing around talking to, I guess he's talking to the doctors, and one of the people from the surgery room that the mother was in falls through the door, and he's covered in blood.
Yeah.
And then you find out that what she's given birth to here is what we would call a monster, right? And the monster has killed everyone in the hospital room there, the surgery room, except the mother. And the whole thing is, this becomes a hunt. It's a dichotomy. It becomes a hunt to destroy this killer baby. And it's also a story about parenting. Okay.
Yeah.
Before we get into the actual nuts and bolts of this, though, so there's a lot going on around this time in the last 15, 20 years before this. I don't know if you know what thalidomide is or have ever heard about thalidomide babies.
Let me break the audience
on this, right? So thalidomide was a drug that was created in the 50s, right? And thalidomide was basically used for a bunch of different purposes, but it was mainly used as a sedative, right?
Right.
So it was mass marketed and produced by Big Pharma, and then they decided that, oh, this is going to work really good with morning sickness, so we'll give it to women for morning sickness. Never testing it on pregnant women to see if there were any side effects.
Hmm.
So thalidomide, women on thalidomide were deformed babies. They were having miscarriages. The babies had terrible physical and mental deformities, all because Big Pharma did not bother to actually do its due diligence and make sure this was good for the purpose it was used for. I am sure that is a huge, especially because we'll talk about the scene with the Big Pharma guy, because somebody shows up in Big Pharma in this movie to talk to one of them. I am sure that that had to be the inspiration for this, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, also, a year or two before this, you have, and I know I don't want to get into politics. I know this isn't a political forum, and I'm not going to bring it into politics. I'm going to mention that within a year or two before this is when Roe versus Wade made abortion illegal.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that a big part of that plays into this, right? So between that, there's a lot of stuff going on, and there's a lot of stuff about deformities and legally terminating pregnancies and things like of that nature. And that plays into what is a very – Brian, I watched the end of this last night. It was like 3 in the morning, mind you. But by the time I got into the end of this, I'm like, oh, my God, this has to be one of the most depressing scenes, films I've seen in maybe since The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, you know?
Yeah.
Because this thing is just – it's gut-wrenching, and it hit me right in the heart, you know? I don't have any kids. I'm not even going out with anybody at this point, but I really feel for this poor mother and father here who are vilified for her giving birth to a monstrosity.
Yeah.
So that's what I took out of this more than anything last night, right? Because I haven't seen this in years, like I said. I saw it a bunch of years ago. Well, I've seen it a bunch of times over my life. But I'm watching this last night. The first thing I see is the doctor, when the mother's on the table, is a dick.
Yeah.
He's trying to say, I just want to give birth. I'm in pain. And he's like, ah, shut up. Don't worry about it. I'm doing my thing. Did you feel that cut? I'm going to pull the baby out. Just don't bother me. Don't bother me. Right? So I'm kind of glad that guy bites it early because, oh, my God. So it gets worse because once – this is just a bizarre – it's so bizarre.
Yeah.
Because in any other movie, you should be rooting for them to destroy the monster.
Right.
You should be rooting for them to destroy something that's putting people's lives in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side, this is a newborn baby.
Right. No. And I mean, you know, you certainly mentioned, I mean, I think, you know, look, I mean, I think you have, especially since it's literally mentioned in the movie that the couple did look into the possibility of having an abortion. You have to talk about this movie in the context of post of Roe v. Wade being legalizing abortion, and we're currently at a point as in this recording where Roe v. Wade was overturned 2 years ago. And so, I mean, that has to be considered part of it. But I mean, another, I mean, you know, it's funny because of the fact that I wonder how much we've talked about the movie a few years ago, but I can't help but think that this movie in a way also inspired The Omen a couple of years later.
Oh yeah. The whole thing about, look, from 68, from the time that, and I'm not a big Rosemary's Baby fan, but from 68 time that Rosemary's Baby hits to The Omen 76, you have a whole bunch of movies where you have the potential of evil kids. And that includes The Exorcist. We discussed The Exorcist, and we discussed the Omen series at length, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the whole thing is, this ties into the Omen because you have a father who, midway through the movie, decides that he has to be the one to kill his own kid.
Right.
And that was horrifying when I was watching this last night.
Mm-hmm.
That was horrifying because here's somebody whose whole life has been turned around, flipped upside down. His role as a father, his role as a husband, his role at work. Everything's been flipped upside down because of this baby.
Yeah.
Like, his boss basically calls him into his office and says, take 3 weeks vacation. But I'm on a big, you know, PR. He works for a PR company. And the boss is basically like, well, you know, mutant babies who are going to kill people, they're generally not good for PR. So you may want to just take that 3 weeks vacation now, right? And then as soon as he leaves, the secretary comes in. He's like, listen, box up his stuff and send it to him. He's never coming back in the door.
Yeah.
This man is losing his livelihood because his child has a birth defect. And basically, let's face it, the fact that it's a monstrosity is a birth defect, Brian.
Yes.
Like, this just opens up all kinds of raw nerves inside me because it's just so profoundly, like, what really upset me more than anything last night is this poor family. All they did was what Americans are told to do. White picket fence, husband goes out to work, mother watches the kids and cooks.
Yeah.
This is totally, that's what the 1940s and 50s set up for Americans. This is what Americans are supposed to do. All they've done is do everything they can to fulfill that role. And because their child is basically has a birth defect, they're now being punished for it.
Right.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm getting a little emotional. Maybe it's because I watched this thing so late, or maybe it's just because this is opening all sorts of stuff up that I wasn't prepared to going into this last night. Because it's so funny, because on the other end, this is just an exploitation flick, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's blood, there's a fucking mutant baby that Rick Baker made. There's all sorts of stuff within this film that leans right into Larry Cohen's wheelhouse and right into exploitation. But it's the best.
No, like, and exactly. I think
the two scenes that really got me were the ones with the milk.
Yeah.
So I had forgotten that in the old days, and I didn't know this, they were still doing this in the mid-70s in California, but you had an actual milk delivery truck who would drop off bottles for the week, right?
Right.
Okay. So what do we associate milk with babies?
Yeah.
Mothers, right? Mother's milk, right?
Mm-hmm.
He kills the baby, kills the milk. And it's beautiful the way Cohen does it because the truck's parked at the top of a hill. So normally you'd see blood rolling down the hill. That would be the go-to on that. That's the most generic thing you do. Instead, you see streams of milk rolling down the hill. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you get to the second scene a little later on where the father is walking around the house and he's looking in the fridge and there's all these bottles of milk, full bottles, right? Because you saw him take them in earlier from the stoop. And then he comes back and those bottles are empty. And he's like, this thing is in the house.
Yeah.
But that tying that to milk brings the whole motherhood thing in it. I think it's kind of brilliant on Cohen to do that.
No, it's fascinating because of the fact that, I mean, it's in a way, like, it points the direction to the Omen where it's like, you know, a father has to kill its child because of the fact that their child is evil. But on the other hand, yeah, you're right. For a lot of this movie, they're very protective of it. And it's especially the mother. The mother has very strong maternal instincts towards her child, regardless of what it's doing. And that is such a fascinating way to approach this material because, yeah, it is exploitation, and it could have been even more so, just, you know, deformed baby just going on a rampage, which is what the movie is. But, I mean, you didn't have to go as deep as you do here. And, I mean, you know, it's hinted at the end of the movie that, this, well, it's not hinted at, it's hinted at early in the movie that this could be a result of radiation poisoning. And it's hinted at the end of the movie in the final scene that there's another baby like this in another part of the country. So to your point, as far as what no doubt was one of the inspirations for this, yeah, I mean, it very much has to be. Yeah, I mean, I'll admit, it's like, I don't think I mentioned it to you, but I was startled by Rick Baker's name on this, and I was startled by Bernard Herrmann's name. And Herrmann's name is interesting. I mean, obviously, this is near the end of his career and the end of his life. The way he scores this is really interesting because, yes, there are moments where you definitely hear vintage Bernard Herrmann, but there are also moments where it feels very contemporary, and I like that dichotomy from him. Similarly with Coen, there are some really great visual choices as far as storytelling here, and the milk being what's coming down the hill was a big part of that. But yeah, I mean, this is an exploitation movie with more going on in it, and that's what's so fascinating. That's one of the things that's so fascinating about it. It made me excited about going back and seeing even more Larry Cohen films going forward.
And I think that part of it is, in the 70s, outside the studio system, you could make horror movies and you could make movies like this and Dawn of the Dead, where if you're an independent filmmaker like Coen or Romero, you can you can have all the gore and splatter and exploitation in the world, but you can put your social messages into those movies.
Yeah.
Because clearly this is on the one level, it's just about a killer mutant baby running around, the cops trying to kill it.
Yeah.
And that's one level, but it's also really a movie about family. And, you know, I got really touched up because the father, the baby ends up in the house and he realizes this. And then, like, it's really weird because the baby shows up at the younger son, the other son's school at one point. And he's in there with the cops. And the cops are like, why would he come here? And the father's like, well, this is my son. He goes here. This is a sixth grade classroom. So I think that because the baby is part of the family, even though it obviously doesn't have a map in front of it telling it this is kid's school and this is the home, that it knows where the kid goes to school. It knows on a genetic level, it's got that information and it knows where the house is. It knows how to come home to mom and dad, right? He shoots the kid. He shoots the baby because he thinks it's going to hurt the other son.
Yeah.
And then they go through this whole extended thing in the sewers, which goes back to our Joseph Cotton act. I kept waiting for Orson Welles to show up in the sewer there. But so you get to the point where the father has a gun. He's got a rifle because he gave him a rifle, and he finds the baby. And he sees it, and it's injured, and it's crying. And he all of a sudden, the light switches off in his head, and he goes from one direction to the other, and he's like, it's okay. I'll take care of you. I didn't mean to hurt you, you know. But they're going to hurt you if I don't. And he picks the baby up in his arms and covers it. And I swear to God, I've never seen so many cops with shotguns and pistols tracking down and trying to kill a newborn in any movie. There have to be 35 scenes of cops with shotguns racing around trying to kill a kid. And I'm like, oh my God, this is insane. We should be pitying this poor family. Mm-hmm. We should be rooting for them. Not trying to kill the kid.
One of the things that's interesting about this movie is that, and you hinted at it earlier, is the whole circus around this experience, right? I mean, obviously it's going to be huge news, this massacre that happens at the hospital, but it seeps into the real life of these parents who not only are dealing with this traumatic experience regarding their newborn, but also are in the spotlight in a way that impacts his job, impacts their lives, and it's just a circus. It's a media circus, and it's a societal circus, and it really does point to this idea. Like, I know, I think there was like a remake of this about 15 years ago. I can't
remember. It's terrible. It's absolutely, yeah.
But I mean,
it's not good.
You could do a really interesting update on this and do it when it comes to like the anti-vax movement.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And just any movement in general where the idea of a child being something being wrong with a child is all of a sudden puts the choices of the parents in the spotlight and a media circus. And you could do a great job with this material, but yeah, it's
because so much of this is contemporary. It's still with us today.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the smaller scenes in there is when the guy from Big Pharma comes to the hospital and he's speaking to the guy who's, I guess, the hospital director, right?
Yeah.
And he's saying, hey, listen, you know, I don't know if this was our stuff or not. You know, we were here and we're in this position now, but this looks bad for us. So I know that you had a doctor say he was going to take the baby and study it, but let's make sure we destroy this baby. Let's make sure there's no evidence that this thing is here. Oh, and by the way, if you'd like, I can get you into our company.
Right.
And it's just screams of Big Pharma, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think on an end note here that this is, I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I certainly didn't pick up. I'm sure I picked up on some of this, but I'm not quite sure I was so in tune as I was with it last night. But there is a lot that Larry Cohen is saying in this movie. And if you're looking for, you know, some challenging things about family and birth and how Americans look at each other, this is a great example of that. And if you want an exploitation flick where Rick Baker put together a hell of a killer baby and there's a lot of blood and gore going on, you got that end of it too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. This was one I did not anticipate having the reactions I did, to your point. And no, it was a terrific choice, and it makes me excited to see more Larry Cohen films in the future. So
you might be about that. Please don't ever see Return to Salem's Lot. I'm just warning you now.
I will take your advice on that one. So that brings us to our third feature of the episode. And this is one that, I mean, honestly, this was the one choice where it's like, oh, well, this is the obvious choice to go to 1974 so that we talk about this one. We've actually talked about the filmmaker here a couple of times, one on film that they made and one in our last episode, because of the fact that he did the original miniseries adaptation of Salem's Lot. We're talking about Tobe Hooper, of course, and 1974's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
So we've actually talked about Hooper three times, because don't forget, a couple of years ago, we did talk about that modern-day classic, Netflix's Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, this is, you know, and what was hilarious was that was a very impromptu discussion, too. Like, I think you put the feelers out there on talking about it, and then I saw it, and it's like, okay, yeah, let's do this as soon as possible.
Yeah, we don't only do the impromptu ones, but once in a while, there's something where either you and I get in touch with the other and like, we got to talk about this now. And that was one of those.
So. Yeah. Yeah. This was definitely one of those. And so it does make sense that we're going full circle, going back to the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And, you know, it's, this is there. I mean, honestly, there's how much is there to say about this movie after 50 years? It is obviously you have the iconic opening narration from John Larroquette, which it's really jarring for somebody. It was really jarring, I think, the first time I saw it, because I was so familiar with Larroquette as a comedic performer. So, I mean, it's so hearing his voice over this movie and saying the tone, it really is compelling. And, you know, this is kind of ground zero for the beginning of the slasher genre. I mean, yeah, Psycho, you can go back to that to a certain extent, but when it comes to the contemporary slasher genre, this is it, right? I mean, teenagers or young adults on a trip, they come across a psycho killer, and there's more to it than that, and we will get into that. Tobe Hooper, the funny thing is, it's like, you know, we talked about the controversy with Poltergeist in that episode where, you know, I can understand to, you know, and on the one hand, I can understand because of the fact that it's like Tobe Hooper, obviously best known for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a movie that is very much the polar opposite in terms of style and storytelling as Poltergeist, but at the same time, you can definitely see in Chainsaw Massacre the way Hooper approaches this gradually unfolding situation that these kids find themselves in. And it's very much in the vein of a slow burn that just goes batshit off the rails by the end. And there's such a brute force intensity to this movie that you see in Poltergeist, and it's something that's very singular to this. And, you know, one of the reasons I dislike the 2003 version is that it tried to slicken up this story. And I'm like, I feel like this story works best because it feels like something illicit, right? In a way, it almost feels like a found footage movie, but there's nobody filming it, but it feels like it's somebody who happened to be with this group who's filming these events.
Sure. So let me just piggyback on a few of those ideas. First off, I actually enjoy and I understand why you would say what you say, because it's a legitimate criticism about the 2003 version. That is one of the few sequels to this, or whatever, one of the few movies under the Texas Chainsaw brand that I actually like, because that's one of the few times where I find Leatherface to be totally menacing. And I've met Andrew Bernarski, the guy who played him. He's just a giant, monster-sized guy, you know? And he comes across as very, very frightening in that movie, which he doesn't in a bunch of the other.
Okay.
As far as my inroad to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this is going to sound silly, and I might have mentioned this previously. I saw Texas Chainsaw 2 first. Because when I was a kid in the mid-80s, my brother and I shared a room, and around the mid-80s, our parents put a television in there, and we had a cable box. So HBO would run Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 all the time, late at night, and I shouldn't have been watching TV, and certainly shouldn't have been watching anything like that, like 14, 15, but hey, here we are, right?
Yeah.
So I had never seen the only parts of Texas Chainsaw Massacre that I had ever seen are the parts that they showed up in the movie Summer School. Have you ever seen that? The comedy from the 80s?
It's been a long time since I've seen Summer School. I do remember watching it, though.
So Dave and Chainsaw, two of the kids, and Chainsaw, obviously, they're huge Tobe Hooper fans, and they get Mark Harmon to show the movie in the And I'd seen, and it I should, that movie's kind of a dick because it spoils the ending by showing you what happens at the ending.
Right.
But the whole thing is, so it came out on DVD. I got a DVD player in 2000, or it came out sometime around then. My friend John, he's a huge horror fan like I am. He said, hey, listen, I was oversized. I was like, you want to watch the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? You're going to hate. I'm like, okay, sure, why not? I'll give it a shot. Great way to pitch it to me, but sure. I absolutely loved it. And he was shocked. Because I'm like, this is a great film. This is a great film because it's so offsetting.
Yeah.
From the very first scenes where you get the camera shots, you keep getting the flash noise, right? And then you get the sun comes up and you see these corpses that are strung together on this tombstone. And I'm like, this is bizarre. I've never seen anything like this. I'm unsettled right from the start here, which is exactly what a horror movie should do, by the way. You should be unsettled in a horror movie.
Yeah.
And it jumps right in on that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, even, you know, and the thing is, it's like, to a certain extent, like, part of the reason why this is very much ground zero for contemporary slashers is because I think a lot of the characters, and I mean, it's a lot of the characters, the adults, the group that is making its way, you know, by the van. This is a really annoying group of teenagers, right? I mean, they're not necessarily teenagers.
Before you go any further, I might hate Franklin more than any character in any other horror movie I've ever seen. He is so annoying. Yeah. And I understand in a wheelchair, and that's a burden for everybody around him, to the point where he has to take a pee, and they kind of let his wheelchair roll down a hill with him in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but the thing is that you could tell, I guarantee the way the character is written, that that's because of a lifelong being upset about being in a wheelchair. That's the take I get from that, right?
Right.
He is so annoying. I just want him to die from the very second I see the family. I see Chainsaw. I see Leatherface, rather, you know?
Yeah.
But you're right. They're kind of like, they're kind of like Dipsy Doodle, you know, Dipsy Doo. You know, one of them's into astrology. It's a very 70s group, Brian.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And, then we get the hitchhiker who comes in, starts to, you know, and he's even crazier than everybody else. And he starts taking pictures. You kind of get the sense that something's off about him, but you're obviously not sure of the full context until much later, and they are running low on gas, and they stop at this house by this packing plant, and basically they go around the house, and then Leatherface shows up and basically starts picking them off one by one. This, I think this might be, you know, and I think I've noticed it before, but I think this was the first time I really was consciously aware of it. This might be one of the best uses of sound design and sound effects in a movie.
Oh, 100%.
Just because so much of it is, there's not a lot of gore in this movie. That is one of the things that is remarkable about this movie. You remember being violent, but it's really not gory.
But getting back to De Palma, I was talking to somebody years ago, this has to be 10 to 15 years ago. And I'm like, oh my God, I saw Scarface, and it has, you know, it's so gross because you watch this chainsaw rip this guy in half, right? Going back to the Palmer there. And then I watched it a couple years later, and the MPA made him cut that so much that you don't even see much of the gore. Yeah. But because De Palma is such a talented filmmaker, and because Hooper is such a talented filmmaker, your memory is that you saw all the stuff that you didn't see.
Yeah, yeah.
And with this movie, I got in an argument with somebody a couple years ago. I'm like, if this came out today, this would be like a PG, because there's nothing in there. There's almost no gore in this. And the guy's like, no, it's disgusting. They'd rate it. They'd have the film board and all that, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no. Okay, whatever, pal. You're wrong. Because there's almost no blood in this thing. Very little.
I mean, I see where you're coming from. I don't think they go as far as PG. They probably do PG-13.
PG-13,
they
sure.
They probably do PG-13 because of the lack of violence. And the intensity, because there are plenty of fantastic PG-13 horror movies that work based on intensity as opposed to violence and gore. So I think PG-13. They would never take it down to PG. I can't imagine they would ever take it down to PG.
I understand that. What I'm saying is that this movie is not gory. This movie is not as gory as most people remember it.
No, and I mean that's why the controversy over Poltergeist makes no sense whatsoever. Because Tobe Hooper already made an intense horror movie with minimal violence and gore. And it was this. And that is one of the most extraordinary things about this movie. And it's all in the editing. It's all in the choices he makes and the way he edits scenes, the way he uses sound effects. It is absolutely, this is a bracing experience from the second that Leatherface comes onto the film.
No, 100%. And so I was glad that you picked this and It's Alive, because these are two different looks at the American family.
Yeah.
Right? So, and they go explicit with it. The second one, you actually, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, you actually get the line, the Sawyer's family. And in the third one, that's actually inscripted into Leatherface's giant chainsaw. You have two very different family units here, right?
Yeah.
You have a family where... Well, let's talk about the quote unquote the first family unit, which I think is the teens.
Yeah.
So Sally is actually Franklin's cousin.
Yeah.
Right? The rest of them aren't actually related. There's five of them, right?
Right.
But they're acting like a family unit. They're going to visit her, I think her grandfather's house or something.
Yeah, something the house like that. Yeah.
Something like that, right? So they're going to wrap up some stuff. I think that the grandfather recently, I'm not quite sure about the details, because they do go to that cemetery at the beginning that's been desecrated, and I think they're going to visit the relative's grave. But you have this family unit that is, and again, this is, like I said, this group of kids is so 70s, they might as well have the number 7 and 0 inscripted on their shirts, right?
Right.
Then you have this other family unit, this rogue, insane, backwoods family unit who is plucking people off and turning them into food, right? Yeah. So I just want to piggyback to something that we said way, way back. I said way, way back when we did our conversation about the Netflix Texas Chainsaw from a few years ago.
Right.
One of the things that when you get past Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, one of the things from 3 on through just about everyone that they forget about is that these people aren't just cannibals and killers for the hell of it. They're cannibals because the meatpacking plant has dried up, right?
Yeah.
Their source of food, their source of economy and ability to buy food has been destroyed by that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've resorted to cannibalism as a way to replace that, right? So it's America eating itself is what it is.
Right.
Which goes back to something that George Romero one time said about Night of the Living Dead. He views the zombies as the neighbors, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is, what if your neighbor was a 6'4" boot-wearing psychopath and a dead skin mask chasing you down with a giant chainsaw, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is really about the destruction of the American family, this movie, on one level.
Yeah.
You know, so you get a different view of it from where Larry Cohen was going, but I think that thematically these films fit together really well.
Well, and it's... Well, in taking it from that context, I think it's interesting because of the fact that, you know, you can look at Leatherface's family in as sort of the haves versus the have-nots, right?
Like, sure,
the big 100%. Corporation, like, they're turning the tables, like. They're, you know, taking, you know, the packing plant is taking, you know, is taking sustenance away from Leatherface's family. So Leatherface's family is going to be taking life from this family it's coming. And it's very much haves and have nots. So yeah, it's
100%.
It's fascinating as social commentary because, I mean, that's... You know, I mean, it was going to be turbocharged in the 80s, of course, but you start to see that build in the 70s.
And one of the funny things about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, too, I love, is that the cook from this one is the only, well, it's Leatherface, but he's the only returning actor. He's playing the same character, the cook, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's got this rolling... It's the rolling, I forget, I have a shirt of it actually. It's like a rolling barbecue grill. So they have a truck that he drives around, and it's like a mobile, you know, chili delivery, because obviously if you can't find the cows there, take it on the road, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the whole thing is that you take people's liveliness away, and again, this is a couple years before the gas prices shot through the roof. And, you know, Vietnam's still going on this time. There's a lot of turmoil. You know, we're headed into a recession shortly after this, a couple of years ago when Carter comes into office.
Yeah.
But all that stuff, like, this is prefiguring where that's going. That, hey, this is American family who has to find a way to survive. And again, commerce is what we're all about in America, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Haves and have-nots, like you said, get the best job, make the best money, eat the best people. And again, like these, like, on a very visceral level, this is about a giant hulking dude with a chainsaw.
Yeah.
But it's so much more than that, just like the other two flicks we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm really glad that you chose these three films, because I think that there's a lot to mine here that casual viewers might not look past the whole guy with a chainsaw or killer baby or those sorts of things, you know? So I'm glad that we're bringing this stuff up, because if you look at these movies, they're a lot deeper than they may appear.
Yeah. Well, and I think Sally and Franklin, I think they're brother and sister, actually.
Are they?
Yeah, I think so.
They might be. They might be.
I think they are. But no, I mean, you know, and, you know, this is, you know, to your point, you've already mentioned Vietnam. This is also... You know, Watergate's taking place and Nixon resigning. This is part of that early 70s. All three of these really are part of that early 70s where society is feeling, American society is feeling particularly grim in terms of how the direction of the country. You know, and that's something that is... That's something that all of these major filmmakers, the film brats, tapped into in a lot of ways. I mean, Spielberg, maybe not as much, but I mean, even in, you know, he had Sugarland Express that came out this year. And that film is about family, that unit that is being separated by the establishment.
Sure.
You know, Phantom of the Paradise is about the corruption of, you know, the music industry and the corruption of, you know, corporation art versus creating art versus selling art. And it's alive about family as well, about this dysfunctional family and about families that are being taken apart because of a freak thing that may not necessarily be their fault. And so, I mean, the thing that I think is one of the things that's so extraordinary about Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that this really should, this should be like one of the most unwatchable slasher movies of all time. The constant screaming that Sally does in the last third of this movie should absolutely grate on us. And it does to a certain extent, but we're so unnerved and we're so caught up in the whole what the fuck is going on of this experience that it's, of course, we're just drawn in.
And I'll tell you where Hooper captures this best in this movie. And that's the dinner scene. Yeah. And here's why.
Yeah.
Here's why. Again, I talked about this earlier with the idea of the nuclear family, right? Dad goes out to work. Mom stays home, cooks, right? Kids go to school, right? And where does that culminate every day when Dad gets home and Mom's done cooking? The family sitting down for dinner. And this is such a subverted, twisted version of the American family dinner that it's brilliant.
Well, and to your point, I mean, Leatherface is done up in makeup and a wig. And he's very much
the mother.
He's the mother in this situation.
Yep. 100%.
Yeah.
He's the mother here. Because someone's got to be the provider. Someone's got to be the provider and someone's got to be the one home making dinner for the family.
Yeah.
And it's just like, on that level, it's just so brilliant. It's just so brilliant that I'm watching this dark, twisted version of what the American family dinner, sitting down for dinner as a family, should never be.
Yeah.
And it totally fits in the context of this film. And it's Hooper's way of giving his middle finger to what's been going on in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And no, this is, it's, you know, I mean, just that. Even if you've seen this before, that third act is so intense. I mean, even when, like, you almost forget to a certain extent, like, as they're trying to get Grandpa to kill Sally, and, you know, he's too weak to hold the hammer and stuff like that, and they keep trying, they keep trying. But it's important for them to have this ritual of grandfather's the one who has to do this. Like, any one of the other characters could have taken over at any time. But it's important for them to continue to have this sense of normalcy to their dinner.
And that also ties back to the hitchhiker at the beginning in the van, because he talks about how part of the problem is they don't kill cows the same way they used to. Yeah. Now they have those fancy air guns that pop the thing in the brain, and all the beauty and art of hitting, all the beauty and art of hitting a cow in the head with a hammer is gone now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, Grandpa's generation has passed on, but like you said, the family is so in tune with following the rituals and ceremonies of the family here that Grandpa's got to be the one to hit her over the head with the hammer.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. And, you know, it gives her a chance to, when she's finally able to escape, she escapes and leads to one of the most unforgettable endings in movie history. You know, one of the most, you know, and it's funny because of the fact that, I mean, you and I have, you, well, you, you, I can't remember. Did you say you finished In a Violent Nature?
Oh, no, I couldn't. That's make right. Past.
So yeah. It's funny because of the fact that we've talked about it, and I'm not a fan of In a Violent Nature. I mean, I think the idea is interesting. I think there are a couple of moments that are decent, but it ultimately doesn't stick the landing because of the fact that it just, there's only so much you can do with that premise of the, from the point of view of the killer. And, you know, it's funny because of the fact that the ending, and part of the thing that irritates me about that ending to that movie is the fact that it very much feels like it's inspired by Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay.
But it also doesn't quite know, it doesn't know when to get out of its own way and just end the movie from there. And it's like, I'm not, you know, and all of a sudden you have this POV change that just, you're waiting for the other shoe to drop and it just doesn't. And, you know, the thing I will say, and part of where this, with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, they don't linger when it comes to the ending. Like, Sally makes her way to getting in a car that's going to help her.
But let's break it down before that. Let's break it down before that, because this is one of the most unconventional endings you'll ever see in a horror movie. And no studio today would ever allow this ending out, right?
No.
So she finally dives out a window from the house and runs into the street. Then the hitchhiker comes, and he's chasing her. But then a semi comes out of nowhere and runs over the hitchhiker, right?
Yeah.
The semi driver gets out of the truck and Leatherface is there. So he throws a wrench at Leatherface. Leatherface cuts his own leg. Then a pickup truck comes out of nowhere. She chases the pickup truck down, hops in the back of the pickup truck, and that's the last you see of her. And what's the last image we see? Leatherface spinning around in the waning sun. This is insane. This is not filmmaking. That's what makes it brilliant.
Well, and it is brilliant because of the fact that, I mean, and you're right, no studio would let it go because the killer's got to die at the end of a slasher now. Like, in a few years, we're going to get Halloween, and guess what? At that point, the killer's got to die at some point. And that basically becomes the MO, even with the never-ending sequels that take place in this franchise, in this series. But, yeah, I mean, no, it's absolutely insane. And I feel like they were trying to do that with In a Violent Nature, but they just didn't, they didn't pull it off because they didn't understand why that ending to Texas Chainsaw Massacre is as impactful as it is.
It's, look, so many modern horror movies borrow from the DNA of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah. And I'll just give you two examples. A couple of years ago when The Strangers Pray at Night came out,
right,
there's a point where the character's in the back of a pickup and the pickup's driving over a bridge, but then the pickup goes on fire. That's clearly right out of it. And then if you reach forward to Halloween 2018, okay, Laurie Strode ends up with her daughter and her granddaughter in the back of a pickup truck riding away from the terror, right?
Yeah.
But none of those movies really understand why that's so impactful and it worked in Texas Chainsaw, and that's why it doesn't work anywhere else.
Right. No, absolutely. No, absolutely.
You know, and I'd say that if you're going to watch three horror films, we're recording this on the day before Halloween, and even if this shows up after Halloween and you listen to this and you're still in that Halloween hangover where you're stretching for great horror flicks, maybe some you've never seen, these are three great flicks to watch, especially if you watch them within a short period of time like Brian and I did.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, very much so. And, no, I mean, I'm very appreciative of again, I am very appreciative, Phil, that you suggested that we pivot to 1974. And this was a terrific group of three films to talk about. And it is, as always, a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, as always, Brian. And I got to say, every time we pick three films, we have a way of picking a good group, a good trio of films every time, I'm pretty sure. We seem to find ways that connect them, and we seem to have some really great conversations. And I'm always happy to talk to you about horror and even genres outside of horror. So,
yeah. And on that note, we're going to be getting back into horror a little bit later on in the year, near the end of the year, but in a very different direction. But that'll be at that point. Again, I'd like to thank Phil Faso for joining me on the Sonic Cinema podcast. It's always a pleasure to talk to him. You can check out the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, YouTube, pretty much any podcatcher that you listen to podcasts on. You can also check us out at patreon.com/Sonic Cinema. Award season is going to be very insane this year. So I'm going to have a lot to say about a lot of very different movies. But you can always check that stuff out at www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much. Oh,